Tina will share the morning scripture reading.
A reading from Psalm 34, verses 17 to 20. When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers them out of them all. God keeps all their bones. Not one of them is broken.
Good morning. It's nice to be with you. Well, normally I get up here and I kind of entertain you with my stories, but today is a time where I'm going to share a different type of story. This is Mental Health Awareness Month, and I've been part of a new organization in Ithaca called Story House Ithaca that has been bringing stories of all kinds, dance, music, song, and traditional storytelling to highlight this month the experiences of people who are either experiencing mental health challenges or are living with people who are doing so. So I'm going to tell you a true story about my life today. My eighth grade social studies teacher waltzed into the classroom one afternoon and announced, "Hey kids, did you know surveys are showing one in four adults are going to suffer a nervous breakdown?" And then his eyes just scanned the room and locked right onto mine. "Oh no," I thought, "it's inevitable. And with odds like those and the way things have been going, I think I'll just get mine out of the way early." And over the next 3 years, a mountain of misfortune would meet a mudslide of bad judgment, and something inside of me would just snap. When I was 16 years old, I experienced severe mental illness. After multiple suicide attempts, my frightened parents took me to a mental health clinic on the upper floor of the closest medical hospital. And while I was there, I paced constantly. I pulled out my hair. I called my mother repeatedly, not remembering that I had just spoken to her. When the art therapist asked me to make a pattern with small, different colored tiles, I was overcome with exhaustion, paralyzed with the choices, and unable to make any order out of the tiles strewn in front of me. I found myself one morning in a dark closet. My therapist was trying to coax me out. When I emerged from that dark cocoon of confusion, the doctors told my parents I needed more intensive care than they could provide, and arrangements were made for me to be committed to Southwood, the adolescent unit for troubled and disturbed teens at the St. Lawrence Psychiatric Hospital in Ogdensburg, New York. How did I get to that point when I was just 16 years old? Well, it didn't happen overnight. Instead, it was a long and complicated journey that's intertwined with family dynamics and events. And let me tell you a little bit of that story. Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy? Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy? Giddy and foolish the whole day through. Boom, boom, ain't it great to be crazy? I'm five. My sister Mary and I are learning to walk on the crutches we have in every room of our house. Now, we have crutches in our house because my dad has been going in and out of the Veterans Hospital for leg operations on his nasty World War II war wound. Mary and I thump swing on the crutches, thump swing. I'm an acrobat at the circus, thump swing. I'm a monkey in a banana tree, thump swing. I'm a Tyrannosaurus Rex coming to get you, thump swing. Hey, Reg, why don't we learn how to go down the stairs on the crutches? Excellent! Yeah, we ran over and up, dragging the crutches behind us. They sounded like playing cards close pinned to a bike spoke. At the top, we surveyed the scene. Long, narrow staircase, open banister, green plaster wall at the bottom. Mary says, uncharacteristically, "You first." "Okay." Thump. I put the crutches on the stair below me, step off, and swing. The crutches clatter down the stairs. I'm catapulting through the air. I gasp and reach for the banister. Mary gasps and reaches for me. And then the green plaster wall is coming closer and closer. And then thump. I awake on the couch. My father is sitting next to me, tenderly patting my forearm. He says, "Oh, I was afraid I almost lost you there, Toots." "That's all right. You snapped out of it. You snapped right on out of it, didn't ya?" I was 9 when the pain and the warm memories made my father smell like a burned match sometimes. He turned the color of skim milk and started to sweat and ripped wall beams out of the wall with his bare hands. I snap awake in Mrs. Kinney's 5th grade arithmetic class. Oh, I got 100. And the little girl who was nice enough to do my homework has handwriting that looks just like mine. I'm 12. Now my father can't really help himself anymore. His arms lift up and crash down upon all 5 of us kids just like waves against a dock. He's become a monster. But I'm the slayer. I jump onto his back. I'm ready to strike. He plucks me off and dashes me against the wall where I run down just like a smashed egg. I snap awake in the school morning announcements. Dr. Forbes, our principal, is telling everybody that I won the school-wide poetry contest. Later at my locker, I ask my best friend, "Hey, Amy, did you see me write a poem?" I'm 16, and it's all gone horribly, horribly wrong. I snap awake in the school cafeteria, food fight going on. Ooh, milk spurts out of a kid's nose. "Hey, Ricky, what day is it?" "It's Thursday." Direct hit to Judy Williams' crotch with rice pudding. Oh, that's going to be hard to get out of those fishnet stockings. "Have I been in school all week?" Yeah, I think. Oh, mashed potatoes on Mr. Reinbeck's back. Somebody's going to pay for that. "Have I been in school all year?" "Well, I hope so. You're the class vice president." "I am? Oh, wow. Oh, that's kind of impressive. How am I doing?" "Oh, fantastic. I'm never going to forget that day you lobbied for the extra study hall and got it." Snap. I wake up in a dark closet. Snap. I'm holding a vial of pills. Diuretics. Apparently, I'm going to pee myself to death. Snap. I'm standing by the side of the road waiting for a car to go by so I can just jump out in front of it. Snap, 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 snap. My parents commit me to Southwood, the adolescent unit for troubled and disturbed teens. We're driving there now in the red, rusted Bonneville station wagon with the wood paneling duct taped to the side. As we're following Route 12 to Ogdensburg, New York, we're going along the frozen St. Lawrence River, which now is the color of corpse blue. My father reaches over and tenderly pats my forearm. "Ooh. I was afraid I almost lost you there, Toots." "That's all right. You'll snap out of this one. You'll snap out of it." And a year later, I do. And my father takes me home. Southwood was made out of curving red stone with 2 turrets on either side, a slate roof, and bars in the windows. When I first entered, a pudgy attendant whisked me away from my parents and up a spiral staircase. We walked down the hallway and past a series of rooms. There was a dentist's office, a doctor's office, an electric shock therapy room, a padded cell with a straitjacket hanging on the doorknob, and then there was the 5th room. The 5th room was a plain, unadorned room with 2 uncomfortable chairs in it. And it was in the 5th room that I would meet my salvation when I was introduced to a tall, red-haired, red-bearded, freckled man with big hands and gigantic feet. He introduced himself my therapist. My name is Jim Flounders. Flounders, like the fish. There were other girls and boys in Southwood, and we were all between the ages of 12 and 18. We were separated by wards that were divided by a long hallway where no fraternizing was allowed. We weren't allowed to wear our own clothes or go outside. We didn't have gym class, and our usual evening meal was cream chip beef on toast. We could watch television in the day room for a little while, but mostly we listened to the radio and played records on our portable hi-fi. Carole King's song, You've Got a Friend, was often followed by Jethro Tull's Snot is Running Down His Nose. Well, it sounds fairly Dickensian, doesn't it? Well, it was, in many, many ways. Those were the first days of lithium that made us drool and walk in a stupor, straitjackets, and something called the sheet. Now, this was the harshest punishment. We were put into straitjackets, tied to a bed with ropes and bungees, and covered with a thick canvas sheet. It had a hole just large enough for our head. We were left in there until we calmed down or were deemed to be good, usually overnight, and until we wet ourselves. And yet, there were kindnesses. The staff threw us a prom with a local rock and roll high school band playing all the greatest hits from the late 60s and early 1970s. We were allowed to wear our own clothes and shoes and perfume and so much trailer trash eyeshadow we could have started our own mobile park. I danced with a boy of my dreams, George. He was egg-shaped, with eyes that crossed and feet that splayed out. His love language was, do you like Pepsi? I like Pepsi. You like Pepsi? I like Pepsi. Do you like Pepsi? We swayed to the strains of Led Zeppelin's. And she's buying the stairway to heaven. One of the attendants took me to a high school musical, Annie Get Your Gun. And if you've ever been to that musical, it starts with Annie coming out and shooting a starter pistol over and over again, and that so startled me and frightened me that I hid behind the chair, but I eventually calmed down enough to sit down and hum along to Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better. The attendant took me out for ice cream afterwards and bought me new underwear at the variety store. Our social studies teacher, Lori, signed a number of us girls out one sunny summer day and took us to her farm, which was really a commune, and as soon as she got there, she took off her shirt. Well, we were a little surprised. They had a big vegetable garden and sold produce to neighbors. She showed us edible plants and told us to go for a walk on our own and come back when we felt like it. Because remember, strangers are just friends you haven't met yet. I had an English teacher perceptive enough to read me Hamlet. Shakespeare gave me language for feelings, thoughts, and experiences I could not put into words of my own. How is it the dark clouds still hang upon thee? To thine own self be true. And the most important, to be or not to be? You see, that was my question. My therapist, like the fish, was the most remarkable person of all. He got a piano and tuned it and told me I could go and play it anytime I wanted. I loved music and singing, and he gave me the gift of creativity, discipline, and a safe place outside of language to express my feelings. Most importantly, though, was the one thing he did for me that I had never experienced anywhere. And that was he listened. He listened as I told him things I had never told anyone. How worried I was about my father's operations, how my mother didn't want to talk to me, and that I had thought she had gone missing without leaving. How I tried so hard to be good, but was never good enough. how the other kids made fun of me, of my constant dieting, my love of music, my desire to go to music school, how I hated and loved my parents and how they hated and loved me, how afraid I was never to be released from the hospital and how I didn't know how I could live at home anymore, but how I had nowhere else to go but home once I was released. The attendants, the teachers, and my therapist nursed me back to sanity and safety with small acts of humanity. But mostly they listened, something I had never experienced in a busy household of seven. Dave Iskay, the founder of StoryCorps, writes that listening is an act of love. Listening, true listening, without interruption or judgment or need to fix, was the grand gesture of generosity that eventually led to my freedom and led me back to sanity. Listening told me I mattered, told me that my thoughts, feelings, wonderings, and experiences were important. Listening pieced my shattered self back together. For me, being listened to was an act of love that strengthened my broken heart and mind enough to eventually lead me to recovery and freedom. But listening wasn't enough. There was something even stronger for me to overcome before I could tell this story. When I was released from Southwood, an unwanted guest climbed into my suitcase and slipped between the socks and shirts. It was an invisible contagion that infected my parents and me. It bore into us and corroded our identities. It would eventually blot out all hope of true love and connection. I was released from the hospital in July, and we struggled to renegotiate family life. My parents and I never talked about me being in the hospital, what it was like for them or me, and how I could adjust to being back. We never, ever, ever spoke of it. During the school year, my parents never notified anyone at school, so that natural question from my friends of, "Hey, where you been?" was answered with unintelligible mutterings and quick getaways. Friends had no clue where I had gone. My parents had been told by the psychiatrist to not visit me very much or hug me when they came, so I thought erroneously that they had abandoned me there. They felt it was their fault but blamed me, and I felt it was their fault and blamed me. We tiptoed around one another like burglars walking on potato chips. We didn't talk about it because we didn't know how to talk about it. And when I was released from the hospital, something moved into our house and slept in our beds, ate at our table, drank our water, and lurked in the shadows. Its name was shame. My parents and I moved into separate orbits of confusion and shame. The silence that shame needs to grow in became more profound as time passed, and I was now the crazy one, forever defined by those months I spent in Southwood. Being hospitalized became the singular story of my life from the time I was admitted until I was 50 years old. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is a Nigerian author of the best-selling book, The Things Around Your Neck. She has an amazing and insightful TED Talk called The Danger of the Single Story. And in it, she speaks about how Africans are portrayed by a singular story that others use to define them and who they and what they become. But what of the singular stories we tell ourselves, the ones that overshadow our complexities and paint us to ourselves as one thing? When we are stuck in that singular story, whatever it might be, it's like a loop that won't let go. It becomes the only story we can tell because it takes up so much room in our psyche. The many other stories that define and express us are drowned out. Adichie says, stories are defined by power, who tells them, how and when they are told, and how many stories are told. Power makes the single story the definitive story of that person or country. And when we insist on a singular story to define a person or a people, we flatten the complexity of our own dignity. She is referring to systemic and sanctioned racism of Africans. But I believe we can also apply her understanding of the singular story to people with mental illness. I told myself a singular story about my depression. I'm irreparably broken. I am flawed. I am unable to handle life. I am unworthy of living. These are some of the stories I told myself. But some of the singular stories were told about me. Sometimes singular stories are told about people with depression, and the story becomes a rut in the road that everybody drives in, never seeing the possibility of another path. So what are some of those stereotypes? They could get well if they wanted to. They just aren't working hard enough. They're just crazy. They're lazy. They want the state to take care of them. How can we broaden our understanding of our own experience by telling the full story? The first time I contemplated my story was when my brother Tim was killed suddenly in a car accident. And I thought, oh man, there's so many stories I never heard from my brother Tim. And this was followed by a second question, which was, well, what stories aren't you telling, Reggie? And Southwood was the one. You know, I was almost 50 years old when I started to work on that story, but I actually was still just 16. You see, I was just 16 for decades. Finding my story was a bit like going on a treasure hunt. Because of my dissociation, I had large gaps in my memory. My mind was jumbled and confused. It was like my life was a sentence out of order. Once upon a time was now upon a time once. Since Southwood was a state mental hospital, I was able to gain access to my records. They arrived in the mail in a large, plain manila envelope. I read Jim Flounder's notes, saw the attendant's signatures, the psychiatric diagnosis, and a note that read, "She's just a spoiled brat." Reading the notes was so painful because it made it real. It wasn't something I had dreamed or made up. I couldn't pretend it hadn't happened. And for the first time I saw the proof of my hospitalization, it was real, and it really hurt. Still, my mind was so confused. When did my depression start? What triggered it? How did it happen? My memory was like a chain with knots in it. It was a big tangle, and I couldn't find the beginning or the end of the chain. My memories were like scattered sailboats in a storm. They were untethered to time and place. I knew I had to tell the story or be crushed by the weight of it. I quit my teaching job and started walking dogs so I could write more. I spent 60 hours a week for 2 years just looking at the records and asking my memories to come back to me. And slowly I began to piece the story together in order, once upon a time. I'm 5 and we're playing with the crutches. I fall down the stairs. I'm 9 when my dad starts to go into white hot rages. He doesn't remember them. I'm 12 when the violence intensifies. I feel sorry for my father. He is so lost, and I am lost too. I'm 14 and my mother stops talking to me. I don't know why. I'm 16 and I just want out. I want out. I'm going to jump in front of a car. I'm going to take pills. I'm going to hide in a closet to blot out the light and the noise and the pain and the fear. I followed my year through. Then something remarkable began to happen, as it always does to me. Memories began creeping out of the background of my mind and now started coming to me. At first one memory and another until I could remember smells and colors, sights, sounds, as if I was right there again. The prom, the musical, the commune, Hamlet, and Like the Fish. I asked the question, yes, you were in the sheet, you were frightened. Some of those attendants were really scary and sexually harassed you. Yes, you were afraid, but what else were you? The pain became tempered by stories of goodness, generosity, and caring. I saw that the people in the hospital really wanted me to get better. I saw the pain my parents were in and the guilt they felt. I saw them as humans, and I was human. A mudslide of misfortune had met a mountain of bad judgment. For me, telling the story first to myself and then to others broke through the chains of shame and silence that had bound me. For for over 30 years and allowed me to reclaim my experience in my own words, in my own way. Once I wrote Snap, I knew I had to tell it. Well, that's the rub. Authors can write their story and put it in a drawer, but a storyteller must tell the story. And I was petrified. I was so scared that I was trembling, and the room was kind of spinning the first time I told the short version of it. The audience went in and out of focus, and all I could really think of is, what are they going to think about me? And this is exactly what I was thinking about before I came up to stand here, because it's so much easier to make you laugh. Will people look at me differently now that they know my story? Those were some of the thoughts going through my mind. But that didn't happen. What happened was people came up to me and said, you know, I was in a hospital. My mother had electric shock treatments. My daughter committed suicide. She never made it out. I wish she could have met you. I wasn't being brave, as people often say about me. I was simply trying to save my own life. So how can we reverse the tide of the singular story? This is by the oldest form of social media: storytelling. Old-fashioned face-to-face listening and telling. As Mary Oliver says in her poem, Wild Geese, tell me about your despair, and I shall tell you mine. Stories about depression are about so much more than despair. That's part of the singular story. When we find a way to share our story, we discover we are no longer alone, and the shame that has grown in the darkness of silence is brought into the light. It withers, and the lies it tells us that we are alone, different, and unworthy lose their potency. They have to step aside to make way for a new story full of complexity, hardship, and goodness. That's what happened to me. I couldn't anticipate that I would see myself differently after telling my story than I did when I started to find the story, that I would feel compassion and gratitude, understanding and sympathy for myself and my parents and the attendants. At first, I just wanted to know what my story was, and now I do. You see, I am a complex, rich person with a history of severe mental illness. I have accepted the help and caring from others to share my story in the hopes that it will bring hope and strength and the very real understanding to others who may be suffering from the same, that recovery is possible, one story at a time. Thank you.